unless they reset it again.
You're right.
The House Committee on Revenue for February 10, 2016 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to go a bit out of order for the hearings today. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4035. Chris, do you want to describe that bill for us, please?
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4035 deals with corporate disclosure of tax return information and would require the Department of Revenue to provide LRO with certain information on C-Corporation tax returns. And then it requires LRO to publish that information in a public report. And the bill outlines the detail of the kind of information that would be included.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, fellow committee members. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith-Warner, and I represent Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose, which comprise House District 45 in the Oregon State House. I'm here today to briefly introduce to you a bill that I introduced in the 2015 session as well, and talk a little bit about it. I want to start with reading you a little bit from the business section of the Oregonian on Sunday. Over the fold, top of the page, article, headline, did IBM deliver on subsidy promise? Oregon gave IBM $100,000. IBM promised more than 1,500 jobs. After a string of layoffs, though, it's not clear IBM came through on a deal it struck with the state and local governments in 2010 when Oregon employment was 10.6%. And after more than a year of inquiries, Oregon officials say they still can't figure out how many people work for the company or if they can make IBM pay the money back. Colleagues, the point of this bill is to indeed help us as a committee and us as a legislature to do our jobs better. Our job as a revenue committee is to adopt revenue legislation in order to maintain Oregon's revenue pool and also to evaluate, diversify, and improve it. The committee needs more information about corporate taxes in order to accomplish fair tax policy for Oregon. Our corporate tax structure has been criticized by some for not contributing a fair percentage to Oregon's overall tax base, and while other critics assert that the corporate tax structure is unfair and unduly burdensome, favoring some corporations over others. Currently, however, much of Oregon's tax policy is based on assumptions. The amount of taxes that individual corporations actually pay is hidden from the public and even from we lawmakers. We do know some things. 72% of C corporations file minimum tax returns. I believe for the year tax year 2012 are the specific numbers that I'm referring to. For most of these, the minimum tax was $150 for the year. However, since large corporations can use some accounting methods to reduce their taxes, many companies actually paid less than the minimum. And as a matter of fact, 393 corporations paid $0 in income taxes in 2012. This is something that we fixed in the last session. It was part of the overall tax credit bill. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but that is some progress that we made in the last session that I think is significant. I have reintroduced this bill. There's the bill itself. I believe there is the one-pager in OLIS, although I would not swear to it. And I wanted to let you know that I did get some feedback after last year's bill, and I wanted to just give you a little bit of that and how I responded to it. I did get feedback that there was a concern that this is proprietary information that we are asking for. And to just review, House Bill 4035 would task the Department of Revenue with compiling information from Oregon corporate income tax returns to publish in a report to the House Revenue Committee. The report would include the top 100 corporations in each of the following categories who also claim among a particular amount, which has not yet been determined, of Oregon tax credits. It would be the top corporations in four categories, taxable Oregon sales, Oregon taxable income, dollar amount of corporate excise tax credits claimed under Oregon law, and total Oregon tax liability. And then in each of those categories, we would do 100 companies with the following information: name, Oregon sales, taxable income, tax credits claimed, total tax liability, and total property taxes paid by that taxpayer during the year. So the feedback that I got from last year were, first of all, that it was proprietary proprietary information. And so for this, it is specifically C corporations. C corporations are public corporations. They file this information at a national level. And what we are doing with this bill is asking that information to be disaggregated to the state level. So it is not information that is not already public. We are just asking that it be disaggregated to the state level. And there was also some question about, this just as a fishing expedition versus having a purpose or a redeeming reason why you're asking for the information. And that is where the is where the inclusion of if you claim a certain number, a dollar amount, and what we're going to try to do with that, we've worked with LRO staff a little bit on this, is to pick a number that makes sense, not, $5 so that everything, but to kind of take a look, arrange it, like maybe pick a median point above which we would use for that information. So that indeed the idea is that by accepting the tax credits, you are agreeing to make public this information because you are already a public corporation and you report this nationally, we're asking you to disaggregate it. Also, I'd like to point out that we added in the information about property taxes as part of we got some information that folks said, well, there are other ways that corporations pay taxes and strong value that they give to the state, like in property taxes. So we included that so that we can get a clearer picture of their overall contribution to the tax revenue, which is really the basis of our being able to provide services as a state. So with that, that concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you for doing this. I think this is important. I think you and I have worked together on an issue of making sure that the state gets a good return on the investment of tax credits that we give. I have to say that I think this goes there are two separate issues here. One is to make sure that we get a good return on investment for the thing that we incentivize through tax credits, and then sort of the broader issue of whether we think a certain category of large C corporations, which is kind of an arbitrary subset of the types of business entities in Oregon, are paying an amount of tax we feel good about. And I think you've done a lot of work on this bill since we last had a hearing about it, but I am still concerned that we are trying to, people have used the word shaming businesses for doing well or being among the 100 biggest ones who happen to have accepted an incentive to do something that we presumably want them to do, which is why we're incentivizing it. So I'm concerned about that. And I'm also concerned that C Corps are really only one subset of a wide range of kinds of business entities, including business entities that get incentives. And so I think there's something to the point that some businesses have raised that they feel like this singles out and sort of unfairly stigmatizes a certain category of businesses who are doing a thing that we want them to do, and that's why we're incentivizing it. But I appreciate the progress that you've been working on, and certainly the important underlying value of making sure we get a good return on incentives that we provide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I hear you, and I would just briefly in response to say so much of this is about our ability to see how we are doing, because indeed we are doing things, we are providing incentives because we are hoping to get certain behaviors. And I think that the more information we can get back about who is using those certain tax credits, and so we can indeed find out what is our return on the investment, I would argue that that is an element. And the C Corps, I completely get that it's clunky, and it was a trade-off between being able to have a defensible response to, are you asking for proprietary information? And by narrowing it to C Corps, it's already public information at the federal level, and just disaggregating them. So, and I agree, it's still clunky. There are still other more information we would not get as part of that. I agree.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you so much. Appreciate the presentation.
See you soon.
We have three people signed up to be heard on this bill. I'm just going to call you all up. Russ Dendro, Tyler McInnes, and J.L. Wilson, please. Russ, do you want to go first?
Sure. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Russ Dondero. I live in Forest Grove, Oregon, at 1506 Olympus Lane. And I've been working with others on this transparency issue now for almost 3 years. And I appreciate Representative Smith Barner's efforts, and we support the bill. And let me give you the reasons why we support the bill. And you have my full testimony on OLIS, so I'm just going to summarize what I think are key points that I would like to stress in the hearing for the record. Number one, good governance depends on accessible and accurate information for both the public and for legislators. Number two, transparency assures the public that their hard-earned tax dollars are being used wisely. Three, such information is basic to our checks and balances system. And as a political science professor who taught at Pacific University for 31 years, I think the latter point is the most important point. We live in a society of checks and balances, and the legislature has a very important function vis-a-vis the executive branch as well as other entities. And so without information, you can't carry out your function as the founding fathers designed for both the federal government and the state government. Contrary to the assertions by AOI, one of the groups that opposed this bill, at least in their submitted testimony, the public is capable of understanding how their money is being spent to subsidize corporations in Oregon, whether it's via tax incentives such as SIPs or tax credits, or whether a public purpose is served. So I have faith the public can discern these issues. AOI's assertion that the public can't understand, quote unquote, the complexities of corporate income taxes, unquote, makes it even more important that legislators have accessible and accurate information to help the media and the public discern these complexities, end quote. In a time when, in the presidential campaign, when candidates as diverse as Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are rallying people around the issue of government accountability and income inequality, how can Oregon do less than shine a light of transparency? This issue is not an Oregon issue. This issue has become a national issue on both sides of the political fence, at least in the presidential race, and it's going to stay there. So trying to find information on state websites is very important. Unfortunately, when I checked the website, there was a list of three websites that were listed in AOI's documents. I could only access one of them. The other two got a response that they were not available. File not found, error 404. I've had the same problem others have in Business Oregon's website. It's very clunky, to say the least. So opponents of this bill, I think, beggar the imagination. The claim that tax information should not be disclosed except in the aggregate is to deny legislators and the public the right of accountability of how their tax dollars are being used and who's carrying the load. Again, democracy cannot function under the aegis of non-disclosure claims. If a corporation wants to do business in Oregon while benefiting from tax incentives, credits, etc., we, the taxpayer, and you, the legislators, as our fiduciary representatives, have the right to know if we're getting a bang for our buck. That will end my testimony. I'll just make a final comment as reference to Representative Lineker's comment. If IBM is feeling the pressure, they deserve to feel the pressure. And so in that sense, any other corporation doing this in Oregon deserves to feel the hot breath of the public as well as the level of disclosure on how they are using our tax credits. Thank you.
Thank you very much. These are not a panel, they're disparate testifiers. I'm wondering, as you may already have guessed, any questions for us before we go on? I mean, not to say you can't have more questions later. Please, go ahead.
I'll go. Thank you, Chair. I'll let this gentleman have the last word. My name is J.L. Wilson. I'm representing Associated Oregon Industries on this issue, and traditionally we've opposed this concept, although I will say this is a far more workable concept than the original 2077 from last session. So I think it goes in the right direction, but there are some comments that I would make, and then I don't want it to be construed that we support the bill, because we certainly don't at this point.
I doubt that anyone would do that.
Companies in Oregon pay their taxes and maximize their retained earnings all within the constraints of the law, and they do what the law allows them to do. And if there's questions about how companies are following the law, or whether companies are inadequately or inappropriately taxed, then you have the ability to get that information and make good decisions on that information. If you believe that companies are running afoul of the law, the DOR is there to enforce compliance and can sue for back taxes and the like. You have a wealth of information already at your disposal, whether it's the DOR corporate tax research, our own LRO, the Oregon Tax Expenditure Report, the Oregon Transparency website. There is a lot of information currently at your disposal to make informed decisions about classes of taxpayers. Where we get concerned, and where I also would say to the representative, your concept is an improvement. We get concerned about singling out companies for the purpose of politicizing tax returns. People aren't honest on tax returns if they feel that their tax returns are going to be politicized. And people are, you know, voluntary compliance is the staple of our tax system, and there is an expectation of confidentiality that goes along with that that encourages full compliance. And so I don't want to get into a situation where companies' tax returns become a basis for politicization. And that is our primary concern, because there are a number of things, and Representative Smith Warner alluded to something, and you as a legislature already fixed, which was on the tax credit. It was the so-called Conway. You had the information to make that decision already, and you made that decision. I can also say with great certainty that the minimum tax on C-Corps is $1,000. I am one of the last dwindling number of C-Corps out there, and I know that well. And so you have plenty of information available to make educated choices on our tax system based on availability of information. And I am concerned about getting into a situation of politicizing tax returns, which is where I think that this this gets us to. And to make one final point, I mean, tax returns are complex. The rules around corporate taxes are complex, and there are things that might not immediately be understood with any particular year's filings, whether that's, and I call it out, loss carry forwards or profitability or some of those things that might skew the numbers or give certain impressions that otherwise would not inform the dialogue, I'd say, in a constructive way. So I'm going to wrap up by saying that I think that the proposal does, it's certainly more workable than 2077, which we saw in a previous session. I think AOI would be interested in that dialogue, because it's a conversation we've had with Representative Leininger, which is making sure you get bang for the buck on your public tax abatements. And I think that is important. And so I think something that goes down that road is important. I'm just but we wouldn't support 4035 as it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Tyler McInnes with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We're here to happily support House Bill 4035. We appreciate Representative Smith Warner's work on this, and any tools that we can have at our disposal to better evaluate our corporate tax structure, we think are worthy, and it's a step in the right direction. I do want to respond briefly to my colleague from AOI. I think the goal is really not to try to catch corporations that are skirting the law, but more to evaluate how well the law is working in supporting an adequate revenue system. I would like to make just a few suggested changes or considerations if we were designing this proposal. One, we would require the corporations themselves to disclose the information to either the Secretary of State or the Department of Revenue, and not have the Department of Revenue themselves being the ones pulling the information. We also think that it shouldn't be limited to multi-state C corporations. We think that it would be useful to be able to determine whether or not our corporate revenue structure is putting Oregon-only businesses at a competitive disadvantage or advantage. And so by including those corporations, that would be useful for a tool like this. We would also include apportionment information for all three apportionment factors to evaluate the impact of single sales factor here in Oregon. And like my colleague here mentioned, we would include other items such as net operating loss carry forwards. We think something like that would be useful to determine the true nature of a corporation's tax liability. We would also include the number of an amount of tax credits on a corporation's books after they filed their taxes to determine future or estimate future tax liability. And we, if possible, we'd like to see some sort of breakdown by industry sector so we can see how different sectors are faring under the corporate tax structure. And then finally, we'd want to know what corporations are reporting to both their shareholders and the IRS in terms of taxable income and liability. So those are our suggestions, but we're happy to support 4035. We think it's a great tool. Thank you.
Good questions. Additional questions. Thank you so much for your testimony. Anyone else want to be heard today on House Bill 4035? Seeing no one, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4035. Open a public hearing on House Bill 4133. Is that yours also, Chris?
Yes.
Yep. And Representative Hayden, you want to come forward while he explains this bill for us?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what the bill does is that it would require the Departments of Revenue and Human Services to implement a pilot program for the monthly distribution of dependent care tax credits. Require the Department of Revenue to provide DHS with a list of tax credit claimants that DHS would then compare to SNAP participants, and individuals on both lists would be then notified that they are eligible to participate in a pilot program that would basically distribute the tax credits throughout the tax year rather than at the time of filing.
Sir, please.
Thank you, Jerry. Chair Barnhart, my name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative from House District 7. I bring Bill 4133 to you again this session for consideration. I appreciate having that opportunity. House Bill 4133 is basically a cash flow problem. It is intended for our low-income Oregonians that struggle to make ends meet and have children. When we have children, that is a priority in our families. We want to make sure that we can feed them, clothe them, give them a place to sleep, and we want good child care for them. What House Bill 4133 will allow them to have the best possible child care that that family can get. What we do now in our system is we make an assumption that families are able to reasonably save 12 months' worth of child care funds through our tax system and receive that on April 15th or thereabout. And then dole that money out throughout the next year. I think logically we can assume that that isn't practical for these families. And so what these families do is when they go and they file with, say, H&R Block, they'll file a rapid refund. We know that 84% of the participants file this rapid refund, and they pay a fee of up to $400 to get this 10 days earlier. Some of these funds are from their own hard work. Some of these funds are contributed by the state. But I think that it would be much more efficient to get these funds to these people monthly and so that they can have the cash flow to pay for their child care in the month that their child needs that child care. There's been a lot of discussion around the legalities of that. We have interacted with the Oregon Department of Revenue and the Oregon Department of Human Services and LC, Lori Freeman. You will find on OLIS an interaction of a chain of emails that includes Oregon Department of Revenue with 13 points. It basically boils down on the 13th point. You're free to read all of it, but it says basically just give us the ability to work with the Oregon Department of Revenue so we can have rulemaking authority. I am more than happy to make that amendment in this bill to give them rulemaking authority so they can work through this. We've also heard from other people that are concerned with the food benefit or the SNAP program that it may create a taxable event for these. We've gone and gotten counsel from our Oregon Legislative Council, and we have written a -1 amendment to this bill that is a workaround that. And basically what it says is, yes, that is correct. When we take lump sum payments due to federal regulation and turn them into monthly payments, it becomes taxable. However, the state of Oregon has the authority to exempt the TANF program, the SNAP program, and the Medicaid program. And so we have written that into the -1 amendment and look forward to having that adopted, whether we do that today or in the future. An amendment that we're working on with the Oregon Department of Revenue and LC is to give them the rulemaking authority. We have heard both from the Oregon Department of Revenue in the literature that you've been given and the Oregon Department of Human Services that they are excited about this new and innovative idea to get the funds to the families in the months that they need it, and I ask for your support.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Hayden? Thank you very much for your testimony today. You and I had a number of conversations about this bill, and I'm excited about the possibility that we may be able to actually help people with some cash flow issues around these concerns. You brought up one that I hadn't thought of, and that was the taxation issue. If, as I think I just heard you say, funds that come in on a monthly basis suddenly become taxable, is that different from funds that come once a year through the other system, or not? Would those also be taxable?
Chair Barnhart, thank you for the question. And the answer is yes, they are different. Under federal regulation, we can, as a state, give a lump sum payment for tax credit to individuals, and that is not a taxable event for them. Federal government says, with several exceptions, which is TANF, SNAP, and Medicaid, that if that is given to them monthly, that it is then a taxable event. But we have an exclusion. Keep in mind that there are 45,000 Oregonians that have been identified by the Oregon Department of Revenue that would qualify for such a program. However, we are not asking for 45,000 members to be enrolled. We are asking for somewhere around 500 members to be enrolled with an opt-out if they choose to do that. So we can certainly pick 500 members through queries with the Oregon Department of Revenue, pick 500 members that the taxable event would not be something that would be a hardship on them, i.e., they wouldn't have even if they did get taxed on these in other areas, it would not affect their financial situation.
Thank you very much. Is that – yes, Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair. And, Representative, thanks for your bill and your testimony. Can you walk through a kind of example family and how this might work in the pilot program, so kind of away from the administrative and technical issues, but how does this look for an individual family?
So we'll just take everybody's tax situation is different, but we'll just take a theoretical family that has two children and say they have an income – that's $18,000 a year, for example. And so they are in under the 100% of the poverty level with the state of Oregon with the children. So those are the families that we would be looking to identify. And let's say, for example, that their tax credit for child care is $1,000 per child or $2,400 for the year. Now, child care tax credits are actually a little bit higher than that. But for the math, let's say they get $2,400 a year for their child care tax credit for their children. And what would happen now is when they get to April 15th, they go down to H&R Block and they file a rapid refund. Now, it has been, and you probably will hear testimony, that the state and the federal government offers those refunds to be filed free. The problem is if you have children and you are struggling to pay your rent, pay your fuel costs to get to work, and are wanting to buy food for your children, you cannot afford to wait that 10 days to get that. So you, 84%, as we have seen in the OLIS testimony here, 84% choose to have that rapid refund brought to them basically immediately, kind of on a loan basis. And so we lose $400 off the bat in that. What this would do is it would get $200 per month on their SNAP card, a system that is currently taking place. The members that will be picked for this pilot project, there is no check coming from the Oregon Department of Revenue. There is no hard copy check. There's no printing. It is loaded onto a cash benefit card, a debit card, if you will, that they already have in their pocket or in their wallet or wherever. And so there's no expense. The Oregon Department of Revenue has offered to query for this pilot project to at no fiscal, and the Oregon Department of Human Services has offered to input that, even though they will have to input that manually because we don't have a system for the Department of Revenue and Department of Human Services to talk to each other. They are willing to input manually 500 members that opt into this program because they're so excited about the idea and the possibilities that it could do, and they will not charge a fiscal on that.
Representative Parrish, did you want to be heard?
I'm here on the same bill, and I'm sorry I was late. I had a kiddos testifying in House Ed, so I had to zip out of there to get here. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, West Lynn and Tualatin. I first want to thank Representative Hayden for caring about this issue and trying to come up with a solution. And when we worked on this last year, it was based on a model that we currently do in government right now that you're probably not aware of. So in the National School Lunch Program, we have a commodity foods that the government front loads schools. So if you sell X amount of lunch in 2014, they front load dollars to you for 15, and then they reconcile you in 2016. So this program is really about a tax filer who filed in 2014. We owed them some money. They took one of these rapid refund loans and lost a chunk of those dollars. And we instead front load them in 2015, and we reconcile them on their tax return when they file again in 2016. It is a shifting, in my mind, it's a shifting of how we bring money in and out, which we did in 2011 with the kicker, right? We said we don't want to necessarily get it in December as a check because we don't have money. That's not when our revenues come in. Just like in a home situation, all your expenses don't come on April 15th. They've been incurring them all year long. And why this is important, you know, when you think about the overall health of a struggling family, is that it really is about things like not having them run up their credit cards, not getting behind on a payment, which hurts their credit score. We're having a lot of discussions, and we'll have more in our committee this afternoon, about the ability for people to pay their rent and stay in their home. Well, cash flowing our taxpayers who are at their neediest level in our system is probably a better bet than waiting for that refund to come once a year, where it may not go to the highest use of what a taxpayer needs to be paying and or to be purchasing. So how do we get them more quality daycare? How do we make sure they can put food on the table? And it is about making sure they have a better cash flow in the time that they need it. So by leveraging a SNAP card, which Department of Revenue and DHS says, look, we load all kinds of money onto SNAP cards. If you're coming out of our prison system onto the Oregon Trail card and you have money on your books, you get those dollars loaded on. So it's not we have all the flexibility we need in terms of putting money on the card. I think this is one of the most innovative possibilities in the delivery of human services that I've probably ever seen, because we are all in this building together trying to figure out how do we keep people in their homes? How do we, you know, get more money in their pocket, which is, you know, your minimum wage debate? How do we make sure they have, you know, the ability to buy what they need for their families? This pilot only right now deals with the daycare credits, which we had huge conversations in 2015 in our committees about daycare. Eventually, we'd love to see this rolled out to the earned income tax credit as well, because ultimately, if we are paying as taxpayers to help subsidize our neediest people, I'm not personally interested in seeing a big chunk of those dollars go out to a rapid refund because they, you know, somebody was struggling so badly that they couldn't wait just even 10 days. I mean, if I file my taxes with TurboTax and I'm owed a refund, federal government's delivering that pretty quickly. But if you're struggling and you're wondering how you're going to pay your rent this month, waiting for that, or the appeal of getting a payday advance loan, which I, for the record, have submitted to you an article from last year that we found as we were working on this bill about just how many cash-strapped Americans are actually turning to this tax advance, you know, which arguably provides a service. But if we can take away a need for that service and not have, you know, 10 to 20% of what taxpayers are helping to subsidize go off to a payday advance, we're actually putting more money back into people's pockets, and that's what this bill does. So it's a small little pilot. I think you'll see that Representative Hayden and I are committed to working with DOR and DHS outside of the session to make sure this, you know, gets off the ground the right way. You might hear, you know, sort of back channel from folks who are worried about what happens to people's benefit levels. If there is a problem, which LC says there's not a problem with that, but if there really were, then I think you would see the two of us go to our federal delegation and ask for a waiver so that we can try something innovative. Because if this works here, it could work everywhere. And this is not just an Oregon problem. This is a problem with all of our poorest in our nation, and try to help sure that they can survive. And this is our opportunity to try that. 500 people, really tiny pilot that everybody's willing to absorb. I hope you will give this your deepest consideration and a yes vote out of this committee.
Thank you. Questions? Any other questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We very much appreciate your testimony. Very, very briefly, we have several people to be heard and another bill. So
thank you. Appreciate the opportunity. I just wanted to say I did meet with representatives of H&R Block, and they will not be opposing the bill, if anybody's worried about them.
Thank you. Let's hear from Tyler McInnes, Matt Newell, James Barta. And now I have John Mullen next after these three. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? Okay. Gentlemen.
Good afternoon. For the record, Matt Newell Ching, Public Affairs Director for Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we very much applaud the spirit of this bill and the reasoning behind this bill. I say that both as an advocate and as a parent of two kids who are in daycare. If I came to my daycare provider and said, I'd like to pay you, but I'd like to pay you in April or March of 2017, would that be okay? They would say, I don't think so, and point to their wait list, and my children probably would no longer have the safe, affordable, and caring care that they currently have. So in terms of the cash, solving this cash flow issue, that is something that is very real amongst families of certainly that we interact with. Our mission is to create a hunger-free Oregon. One of the pillars of that is creating family economic stability. We start from the value proposition that all working families deserve a safe, caring, affordable, and enriching environment for their kids while their parents are at work. So I'd like to applaud Representatives Hayden and Parrish and others for bringing forth this very worthy idea. So in the spirit, I would like to offer just a few suggestions that we make sure that we consider as we do, both during this hearing and moving forward, to make sure that we don't have any unintended consequences here. Both Representatives Parrish and Hayden brought up the issue of whether changing this from a lump sum tax credit to monthly installments would impact what is considered countable income for the SNAP program. It is our opinion, and actually we appreciate Representative Hayden approaching legislative council, getting an opinion there. We think the jury is still out on this one, and we would very much appreciate some certainty from USDA Food and Nutrition Services before we proceeded with this bill to have a final answer, because the truth of the matter is I can have an opinion on what's countable income for SNAP. Legislative Council can have an opinion on what is countable income for SNAP, but the ultimate decision maker here is USDA FNS. It would be ill-advised to proceed with a bill where we don't know the answer to that question as to whether a family could potentially lose or have their SNAP benefits. And we're talking about SNAP benefits. We're talking about food assistance here, so reduced or eliminated. Because if a family needs child care assistance and food assistance, it's kind of a Sophie's choice to say, okay, you got to choose one or the other. We do not want to put families in that situation. So I think it's imperative that we have absolute certainty that this is not going to harm people's food assistance in trying to make sure that they have access to child care. One other issue that we want to bring up is this: whenever you're trying to figure out what a taxpayer's tax liability is going to be in the future, you're going to be estimating what
income they have in the current year. For many low-income families who are on SNAP or otherwise, they're working part-time jobs. Many have multiple jobs that they're juggling. Hours fluctuate. There are many circumstances that make income variable month, week to week, month to month. And so projecting what a family's income is going to be accurately would be crucial in determining what their child care benefit would be. If you don't get that right, there's a strong chance that you could end up with a taxpayer having significant tax liability the following year when you try to reconcile those two things. And so we don't want to put people in a position where they unanticipatedly owe more money than they thought they were going to come tax filing season, because then you're talking about wage garnishment and really tough issues for taxpayers. And just the last thing that we would ask that you consider is currently, as written, the bill reads as an opt-out, so families would automatically, for those families in the pilot, they would automatically be enrolled. We think that should be an opt-in, and I'll tell you, and it goes back to this reason that a family knows its individual income circumstances better than we do. We start from the proposition that a family is families are experts in their own lived experience. And maybe there's reason for that family to believe that their income is going to be relatively stable over the course of that year. If it's not going to be stable and they're automatically enrolled in this, and they do not take measures when their income when and if their income fluctuates, they could be facing these tax liabilities, you know, in the following year. And so we need to make sure that for those that are participating, it's voluntary, and that they are have the resources and have the education in terms of when to report income differentials, so that their benefits are squaring up with what their tax liability is going to be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, again, Tyler McGinnis, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I want to echo what my colleague has said here. You know, we very much appreciate the intent and the spirit of the bill. We appreciate Representatives Hayden and Parrish trying to address cash flow issues for low-income families, because that is a very real problem in Oregon and something that we need to pay more close attention to. But would also, again, echo that this bill shouldn't move forward unless we have absolute certainty from USDA, FNS, that that these benefits moved into monthly allocations, that they would not count against someone's countable income when determining SNAP benefits. And again, that we would prefer to see this as an opt-in program rather than an opt-out. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is James Barta. I'm the legislative director for Children First, and we are, as Children First, we're advocating for a long-term systemic change that improves the lives of children and their families. And I'm in the peculiar position to not only agree with my fellow panelists, but agree with the representatives that testified earlier. We're extremely grateful to Representative Hayden for bringing this idea forward. We are simply fearful of laying, in a sense, a trap for these families, that if we don't know for sure what the federal government is going to determine, they could be losing their benefits. And that is the last thing that any of us want to see. And so we look forward to working with Representative Hayden, Representative Parrish, and whoever else to ensure that this program will be a success. And we ask that the committee and whoever else, you know, take the time to check with, ask DHS to check with USDA FNS to determine for sure that these reoccurring payments would not, it would be classified as emergency payment if necessary or whatever, in order for this liability to not account against their SNAP benefits. And so simply echoing the previous testimony, I appreciate your consideration on this.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Colleagues, let's call John Mullen, and then I'll make the comment I was going to make. Mr. Mullen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I will be very brief. I know you have another bill here. We have a long track record, the Oregon Law Center, in working on low-income related tax credits. And I want to just again echo my colleagues in signaling our appreciation for the the issue and the idea is very innovative. I think one of the things that when we think about ways in which we can help low-income people, there's the other side of the equation, which is do no harm. And I think you've heard some examples of both on tax issues and overpayments. Now, having said that, I think that we should get a definitive letter from Food and Nutrition Services, because I do agree with what Representative Parrish said. There may be an opportunity for a waiver or a way to work around what is currently the law of the land, the way Food and Nutrition Services looks at the issue about treating this as income. I think maybe it's an antiquated issue and something that needs to be changed, and Oregon has very much been on the cutting edge of innovation on a number of issues. So I will pledge that if this moves into an interim discussion, that we will continue to work with the proponents of this particular legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Mullen? Well, let me make a comment then on these issues. We heard a similar bill in 2015. We had a hearing on it. I think at that time it was clear it wasn't ready to move. The different sets of issues have come up this time than came up last time. I have to say that the idea is extremely intriguing to me. When you think about the way in which people's budgets actually work and the desire to have a monthly pot of money from which to pay expenses. So that's the part of it that's intriguing. Obviously, it's not ready to go today or soon. But I would commend Representative Hayden and others who would like to form a work group on this issue to use the good offices of the Legislative Revenue Office, the departments that apparently are prepared to pursue this, to get answers to these questions and see if we can figure out how to move along with it. And I think I, for one, would look forward to an additional conversation and maybe a statute in 2017. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4133, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4026. And before Chris gets going, let me simply say that I've tried to make it abundantly clear that the purpose of opening this bill is not to look at the bill as printed, but rather to consider the fact that we have a relating clause which is useful for the purpose of amendments. I think he's going to talk about one or two of them, and then I think there is another amendment that some people want to consider, and I hope that they'll come forward and testify about it. Chris,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the main amendment, if that's the appropriate term, is the dash three. In OLIS, there's a dash one, a dash three, and a dash four. The dash four is an unrelated issue that I think you'll hear about separately. And the dash three replaces the dash one. The only difference between the two of them is that the dash three provides the Department of Revenue with some rulemaking authority. So what the dash three does is that it changes the method of apportioning corporation income from the sale of intangibles and services. So it does not pertain to the sale of tangible personal property. The bill would replace the cost of performance method with a market-based method and would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2017. The committee heard some testimony from heard from the Department of Revenue during legislative days on the issue. And in here, I have a document. It's titled Simple COP Examples. That I'm going to talk about in a second. Just so everybody's aware, there is paperwork in here. The fiscal impact for the dash three is a minimal, and the revenue impact is an indeterminate. So in an attempt to just refresh the committee's memories about the potential revenue impact here, there is the table that's up here on the screen. It's titled Oversimplified. Maybe it should be grossly oversimplified. Examples of moving from the cost of performance to the market-based apportionment. Just to get at, the revenue impact is indeterminate because there will be a mix of corporations who have tax increases and tax decreases, so it's really indeterminate. So I wanted to come up with an example that tried to, as simply as possible, convey an example of a so-called winner and a so-called loser with respect to taxes. So in example one, we have a corporation that operates in Oregon in state A and state B. And the two lines there, the share of their costs across those three states are 40% in Oregon, then 35%, and 25%. So that's a total of 100% of their costs. The next line is the share of their where their market is. 30% of their market is in Oregon, 40% is in state A, and 30% is in state B. So again, these are for the sale of intangibles and services. Under the cost of performance method, because Oregon's share of costs is 40%, it's a plurality, all of those costs would be assigned to Oregon. So 100% of their income would be attributable to Oregon. Moving to a market-based approach, that 100% would be reduced to 30%. That's their share of their output going to Oregon. So in that case, 100% of their taxable income would come to Oregon, would be reduced to 30% and resulting in a revenue loss. On the flip side, under example two, the same three states, the share of costs and the share of the market are different. The share of costs are 35% for Oregon and then 40% and 25%. The share of the market is in 50% in Oregon, 35%, and then 15% for states A and B. So under cost of performance, Oregon would have 0% of the taxable income because the plurality is in a different state. It's not in Oregon. Under the market approach, Oregon would get 50% of the taxable income. So in that case, this would be a revenue gain to the state, or the corporation would be paying more taxes because the share of the taxable income attributed to Oregon would go from 0% to 50%. Now this really is grossly oversimplified, and corporations I don't know that this really exists in reality. Corporations will have a mix of sales and so forth, but just to convey an example, the point of this was to show a revenue gain and a revenue loss. So a corporation that would have an increase in taxes and a corporation would have a loss in taxes.
Okay.
So just a brief refresher that hopefully didn't do any harm.
Well, let me reduce the oversimplification a little bit. If I can put it that way, that sounds like an economist speaking, doesn't it? Let's suppose that state A and state B, in the first example, use the share of market approach to taxation, where we use the cost of the share of costs approach. If I understand the way this works correctly, we would tax 100% of the sale, or the income based on 100% of the sale. State A would tax 35% of the income based on the market, the fact that they're 35% of the market, and State B ditto, 25%. So the corporation would actually pay taxes on 160% of its income, assuming that other states had the rest of their income tax system was similar to ours. Is that what would actually happen in the real world in this odd example?
That potentially could happen, yeah. The amount of taxable income could be greater than 100%, depending on how the systems in state A and state B, and I specifically said state A and state B rather than identifying states that might have market approaches. But your example would, if I followed it correctly, that could certainly happen.
So then, and the opposite is also true, isn't it? That if Oregon used a market-based approach, and the other states used a cost-based approach, and we were using example B, it could very well be that a corporation would only be taxed in relation to half of its sales rather than all of them.
Correct. It gets really complicated when
really quickly. And we had a hearing, as committee members will know, we had a hearing in January as the interim committee on exactly this topic. Would you remind us what's happening in other states? Are things trending in one way or another around this question?
Generally speaking, the discussion is being had and states are moving to more of a market-based approach. A very brief history is that 30, 40, 50 years ago, services were not a significant share of the economy. The economy was based more on goods producing, and all of the services were presumed to be produced and provided locally. And so it wasn't an issue 40 years ago or so. But as the economy has shifted from a one centered on goods to one centered on services, it has become more and more of an issue. And with states adopting, for example, as Oregon has, the single sales factor, going to a market-based approach has been the tendency. Now, there, having said that, there are a lot of nuances about how a market is defined and a lot of detail around there. So not all of the it's not as though all of the states, and I think you'll probably hear some testimony to this, that not all of the states are exactly on the same page as to what it means specifically with respect to market, but at a very high level, moving away from the cost of performance to a market-based is something that is going on throughout other states, at least having that discussion and figuring out what it means. You have a lot of services that are provided remotely, and so lining up public policy or taxation policy around the sales concept is something that has been happening.
Yes, Representative thank you, Smith-Warner, Mr. Chair. Please.
If I may talk less like an economist and maybe try to move back towards the more simplified version, the premise is it's like single sales factor for services.
Correct.
Is that accurate? Okay, sure. So this moves. So the way we tax goods, companies that produce goods right now, is single sales factor. And this would move the way we tax companies that make services in a single sales factor manner, in the same way. Is that accurate?
Right. That would be okay. Aligning that policy.
And I'm not an economist.
And it's of course, it's how we apportion that single factor across different states. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Chris, thanks a lot for simplifying things for us legislators. In the just very quick sort of refresher on this, recalling the interim hearing and looking into some of the materials in the last couple hours when I found out about the amendment, concern or criticism is that when you're dealing with services or intangibles, the larger question of where those are delivered comes up because it's easier, I suppose, to say where a tangible good is sold, where it's delivered. It's more difficult to say where a web service or a any other sort of service in the modern economy is delivered. How is that dealt with in this amendment, or is that a subject of rulemaking, or are we at?
The language in here is based on the MTC recommendation, so it's based on that, and as at least a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
And it does grant the amendment as drafted would grant the Department of Revenue rulemaking authority to hash out a lot of those details. So there is some direction provided in here consistent with the MTC. Not everybody's on the same page with MTC, but for purposes of this, that was the starting point.
Would you tell us again what MTC is?
The Multi-State Tax Commission.
Okay.
So and that's an attempt to get all of the states on
or
the same
literally
page.
Compact, isn't it?
Well, there's a Multi-State Tax Compact, yeah.
Right, and that's what you're referring to here, isn't it?
Yes.
The compact.
Yeah, they've proposed language for that.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
That was my question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Other questions for Chris before we go on? Thank you. We have three witnesses today, one of them by phone, from Eugene. So let's hear from Stephen Michael, and let's see if we can also get Sabrina Parsons on the phone. I'm not sure quite how that's being set up, but I assume somebody does. Mr. Michael, why don't you go ahead? I'll look around and we'll get it all done.
Sounds good. thank you so much, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Michael. I'm the acting state director of the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We work with small business owners all across the state. It have been for the past nearly 10 years now, working and talking about a variety of different issues, from taxes to job quality issues, with a real focus on ensuring that we get the actual voices of small business owners heard on these issues.
This is Sabrina.
Let me interrupt just a moment. Sabrina, this is Phil Barnhart. I'm the chair of the Revenue Committee in the Oregon House, and you're on a speakerphone in front of our multitudinous internet audience today. We're hearing right now from Stephen Michael from Main Street Alliance. And if you'd stay on the line, we'll be ready to take your testimony in a couple minutes.
Great, no problem.
Thank you very much, Mr. Michael. Please
and,
go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I can be brief as well. We're here today. The Main Street Alliance of Oregon supports the Dash. We were supportive of the Dash 1 amendments, and as I understand the changes with the Dash 3, we would be supportive of the Dash 3 amendments as well. Essentially, from our perspective, this move would create a more equitable tax system in our state and reduce the competitive disadvantages that some of our Oregon-based companies are facing with regard to taxation and from companies service-based or intellectual property-based companies in other states. As you all have been hearing already, there's a trend towards this. 19 states have already moved in this direction, and we really see this as Oregon really getting getting up to speed with the way that things need to be going in our changing economy. Overall, switching to a market-based sourcing would make Oregon's in our perspective would make Oregon's tax system more fair for Oregon-based businesses, and cutting taxes on Oregon companies, ensuring that we're, you know, increasing those revenues from companies that we're not receiving any taxes from right now because of the way that our tax system is set up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If you'll stay right there,
absolutely.
We're going to hear from Ms. Partisans, and we may have questions for both of you. Would you state your name for the record, please, and then give your testimony?
Yes. My name is Sabrina Parsons, and I'm the CEO of Palo Alto Software, and I really just wanted to be able to give some testimony and support the amendments that are being proposed to HB 4026. I agree with what Stephen has stated, and as someone in the software business in Oregon, I think it's really important and vital that these changes are made, and we'll put Oregon in a better position as we really put a lot of focus and energy into growing the tech sector of our economy and the software sector of our economy to be able to follow what California, Washington, and 17 other states have done and really just fix something that I think was maybe not the intention originally and is inconsistent in the tax law, so that as a software developer, we're not getting taxed in an unfair way and in a way that other companies in Oregon aren't getting taxed, I think is absolutely critical for Oregon and for Oregon continuing what's been happening in the last few years in terms of growing our economy through high wage, high tech jobs by, you know, way of companies like mine growing and starting up and deciding to move to Oregon.
Very good. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Michael, Ms. Parsons? Representative Bence, please.
Thank you. For the slower of us, Mr. Chair, perhaps I can take us through and explain what would change if we adopted this. Tell us how you would be benefited by virtue of the take us through it really slowly so that we get it.
So I personally wouldn't be benefited from this change.
Software.
I feel like Sabrina, who's one of our executive team members at the Main Street Alliance, would be a better voice for that and how she would be benefited from this change.
Ms. Parsons, you want to attempt that question? Did you hear it okay?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of how we would be affected, as we look at bringing in different kinds of tax revenue to Oregon and initiatives on the ballot that are trying to figure out ways to bring in additional revenue for healthcare and education, there are some implications right now if this doesn't get fixed. For a company that's in software to have to be treated differently when, you know, for instance, Palo Alto Software sells in 182 countries around the world. We sell in Oregon, but it's proportional to the population of Oregon compared to the rest of America. So our sales in Oregon are actually, a very small portion of our revenue, and yet we would be taxed as if all our sales were in Oregon. And it just is a situation which continues to perpetuate the idea that the state of Oregon is maybe not as friendly to business as it should be. I am a person and a CEO who really understands that we have to fund things like education and healthcare, and I sometimes support things that other fellow software companies don't support, but that's more because of a personal stance I have than a real clear business reality of what it means to the business. So it would be a really important change that also just makes things equitable. I'm not selling all this software in Oregon, and so to be taxed as if I'm selling 100% of my software in Oregon because of this inconsistency in intellectual property and the definition of service as it relates to software, or software as a service, which is really the way of the future, just seems like it's short-sighted for Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Bentz? Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for your testimony today. I'd simply note that Ms. Parsons and Palo Alto Software is a very substantial member of the Eugene community, for those of you who are not familiar with them. And we very much appreciate your testimony today.
Oh, thank you very much. And I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person. So I appreciate you allowing me to call in.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Is there any, now, we've got another amendment that people want to be heard on. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this one, the -3 amendment, having to do with this issue? There's a different issue as comes up when you have an interesting relating clause. There's a different issue that people want to talk about. If we're finished with this one, I'm going to go on to the other one. All right. Yes, please. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Jody Weiser.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I might be reading, oh dear, you moved the screen. I might be reading it wrong, but I believe it's Section 6 that seems to say that if you don't have any sales here and your sales are to a place that don't tax you, you won't have to be taxed. And I believe that our law for a single sales company is if you're not taxed in the other place, then you will be taxed here. So I don't understand that difference, and I could be totally wrong.
Let's ask LRO.
I believe Jody is referring to, it's on page 2, lines 14 or 15 through 20, and this is commonly referred to as the throwout rule. And so if you have sales that can't be identified to a state, then they would be thrown out of the denominator. There is some concern about that policy, and because that can cause distortions to the apportionment factor.
Is that based on the what did you call it, the MTC?
This is part of the MTC. I believe some other states have adopted the MTC but not included this language.
All right. Representative Bentz?
Well, thank you, and I'm glad you raised that issue. Let's use Washington as a good state. So no income tax. We identify activity in Washington, but there's no income tax. So that means that activity would not be in the denominator. Therefore, we would enjoy all of the tax revenue from that activity in Washington, we being Oregon. Do I have that right?
Potentially. I've had some discussions with folks about this, and there's the issue of whether you can identify the sales to Washington and whether or not the corporation has nexus there, and then what to do in that case, versus the case where you have sales that can't be identified to any particular state. And in those cases, whether and how exactly how those should be handled, if they should be removed from the denominator or if they should be removed from both the numerator and denominator. But the issue is how those get handled.
Right, you follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Right, and so the question would be, today, if using our current arrangement, if we trace those sales into Washington, we do an apportionment, just as you showed in your little squares. and thus Washington would enjoy the opportunity to tax that, but it might choose not to, which, because it doesn't have an income tax, so it wouldn't. But neither would we. Do I have that right under the current situation?
Well, then we'd have to be talking about tangible products.
Correct.
Because under intangibles, it's a cost of performance. So for tangible, if we shift gears and talk about tangible, then there are some potential throwback rules.
But under the follow-up.
Please, yeah.
Under the proposed approach, what would end up happening, I think, is we would kick over to the Department of Revenue rulemaking to address the conundrum you just described.
Potentially, yeah.
Right, and they have a requirement in both the rulemaking and in administering tax returns to make certain that they manage the tax system fairly. And we used that provision last year in trying to resolve some other issues that we were dealing with at the time. As you recall, when we had a very complicated amendment that we ended up dumping because we decided we didn't need it because of that rule. Senator, did you want to be heard on this? Oh, sorry. It's a different issue. All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I'd like to go on to the other amendment, the other topic that's part of this hearing. We have a Dash 4 amendment that we received today. Chris, are you able to describe that to us?
Sure.
Or should I let the witnesses do that?
Either way, it's related to a potential PSU tax, a payroll tax up in Portland related to Portland City.
Very short, very simple. Why don't we have Marcia Haynes describe it to us? And then we have one other person signed up, Deborah Koreski. Is there anyone else besides these two who want to be heard on this amendment? Why don't you come to the table then? It will just save us some time moving around. I doubt very much that they're in the same position on this measure. Would you describe the amendment for us, after you've stated your name, and then give us your testimony?
Sure. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Marion Haynes. I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs for the Portland Business Alliance. We represent almost 1,900 members, business members, within the Portland metro region. The Dash 4 is a pretty simple amendment. It simply says that a public university, a state chartered university, may not receive revenue from a payroll tax imposed by a metropolitan service district. And in essence, what this would accomplish is to say that PSU could not go to Metro, for example, in the Portland region, and levy a payroll tax for their benefit. from our perspective, PSU is bringing this up. We view this as a statewide issue, and that's why we have this before you today. And I'll explain why I think there's a couple of issues. And I would start by saying we have a long history of working with and supporting PSU. It's a rather awkward position that we find ourselves in. We help support the rather historic increase in funding during the last session, an additional 24% for the higher education system. From our perspective, one state university, the Portland metro region generates probably the majority of payroll taxes, at least half of the payroll taxes that the state would businesses in the state generate. And under this proposal, it would go to the benefit of one single state university. We view this as more of a statewide issue. We have a statewide system. It's always been funded that way in the past. And this would be a great departure by taking advantage of the fact that their main campus is located in the heavily populated metro urban area. One of the things that it would provide funding for PSU, it would also raise money for scholarships. That's a hugely important thing. We understand that student debt is a really big challenge right now. However, if there's a student from the metro area who has a demonstrated financial need, money raised through this could only go to PSU. They couldn't take that scholarship money that they might desperately need and go to the University of Oregon or Oregon State or OIT or Southern or Western or Eastern. And we think that that's a problem. This also expands Metro's jurisdiction beyond which it has right now. Metro's charter says that their jurisdiction is over matters of metropolitan concern. That is set by current and future state law. This would expand their jurisdiction specifically to say that PSU funding is a matter of metro regional government's jurisdiction. And given the interaction between the state authorizing what is in their jurisdiction, that's why we bring this to you today for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi. For the record, my name is Debbie Doris Kresge, and I represent Portland State University. And it's fun to be back in this committee. I feel like I spent lots of time in this committee when I was a legislative staffer, and I haven't been here since. So I'm happy to be back in front of the Revenue Committee. This was always my favorite. You have to be smart to be on this committee. There is a citizens committee that has filed It's meaty stuff in the Revenue Committee. There is a citizens committee that has indeed pursued a strategy for Portland State to one of the many tools that the universities had when we got the passage of Senate Bill 242 and 270, which sort of the legislature said to the universities, you know, it's probably never going to go back to the way it was. We're never, if you're over the age of 50, it's likely that your state, if you went to a public university, covered about 80% of the cost of your tuition and attendance. That has, when I went to school in the 90s, my state, Mississippi, covered about 60% of the cost of my attendance. Students today are lucky if the state picks up 20% of the cost of their attendance. So that's a big title shift. I mean, it's a major challenge for states, not just Oregon, but other states like us. We are sort of on the forefront of experiencing that during the recession. Oregon's universities raised our tuition about 40% over the course of a decade. And all universities in Oregon are experiencing severe financial hardships. I think in this body, we like to compare U of O to PSU. And when you do that, U of O looks great. But when you compare U of O to University of Virginia or University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, you can see how much they are struggling. When you compare Portland State to the financial challenges that are happening at Eastern, we look okay. But when you compare us to the University of Memphis or the University of Cincinnati, you can see the struggles that we're facing. So these are conversations that have been happening since my time that I joined the legislature as staff in 2003 about what to do with Oregon's universities. And I feel like we're still talking about it. Representative Johnson has heard ad nauseum about possible solutions. So if you're interested in what the Citizens Committee is interested in asking the voters of the metropolitan community, I would suggest that we invite them here so you can learn more about what they're asking. But on behalf of the university, I would say, every university was given more tools, and we would like to continue to have the opportunity to pursue every tool so that we can do the best job that we can of serving the students in the metropolitan region. We've been in conversations with the Portland Business Alliance, who have been huge supporters of our university and all of Oregon's universities. And I would agree, it does put us in awkward situations when we don't agree and we find ourselves in front of a committee unexpectedly. So if you're interested in the ballot measure, we can have people talk to you about what their thought processes are or what it does or does not do. But this is an amendment that says that committee should not even have the opportunity to have that conversation.
Thank you very much. Questions for these two? I have a couple. Representative Vance, do you want to go first?
Go ahead. I'm thinking.
Well, I take it from what you said, Debbie, that this is not an initiative from the university. It's an initiative from another organization. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, there's a citizens committee that's been exploring this. And, of course, I mean, our president has been intimately involved in this. This is not an idea that's new to people in the university. Okay. If you've been around the Oregon legislature for a long time, you know that PSU used to have another Debbie. Her name was Debbie Murdoch, and she was a fierce advocate for Portland State. She did a much better job than I could ever do. But she had these conversations way when about would it make sense for an urban serving universities whose sole mission is to serve students of the metropolitan region. I mean, that's the formation, the creation, the mission of Portland State. Does it make sense for that metropolitan community to step up and say, you're different than the statewide universities of Oregon State, and we're going to have a different relationship with you. The city of Portland created an urban renewal district for Portland State. That's since been rejiggered, and other additional revenues were provided for the university. So I think that other urban-serving universities have had these types of conversations with their communities, and every community has chosen to kind of do that differently.
Now, Representative Benz.
Sorry.
So it strikes me, as I look at all of these different efforts to balkanize Oregon when it comes to tax policy, that there needs to be these kind of issues need to be brought right to this committee by Portland or universities or whatever. The reason it has to do with the burden of trying to keep the whole state going. And so when we can have everybody run out and begin to raise taxes here, raise taxes there, but it all has an impact on the overall ability to tax whatever activity we have in this state. So how would you justify, is it because we haven't done our jobs, so you've said, okay, we've had enough of waiting for you guys, therefore we're going to just tax whatever we can tax, and it's a matter of survival? Is that where you people are, or is that why you didn't come to us?
Portlanders.
Yeah, Portlanders. Yeah,
us Portlander people. I actually live in Salem, but I understand what you mean.
The point is, this issue is you're not by yourself in taking these attempts, whether it's cigarette taxes or whether it's any activity that where some group wants to do something, road taxes. We see it all over. So really, what is it that drives this, in your opinion?
I think urban serving universities have a unique mission. I think that if you look at the mission of Portland State, why we're created, and who we currently serve, about two-thirds of the students come from and stay in the metropolitan region. That is significantly different than most of the other universities, except for the other regionals. I think the thing that makes us different is we are so much bigger. You know, the regionals get extra state support that PSU doesn't get because of our size, because they know that they are serving place-bound students. That's very similar to our mission. So I think Portland State sort of, I'm from a large family, so I always explain it this way. We are the middle child. We are not one of the big kids, and we are not one of the little kids. We've always been in this kind of middle child position, and I think that supporters of our university understand that to continue to be able to serve those very place-bound students of the metropolitan region, that the state no longer is going to be able to provide the financial resources for us to do that, and that philanthropy for us, unlike our bigger, more established, longer serving institutions at OSU and U of O, we're not going to reach that. We've significantly increased philanthropy, but we're probably not going to reach that level in the next 20 years. And unlike the four smaller universities who seem to be able to make the case based on their size that they deserve significant more funding per student than what we receive from the state because they are small. They get the equivalent of the small school funding formula.
Yeah.
It's not exactly the same, but it's similar.
Yep, please, sure. Please follow.
So my question, I appreciate the background, but my question was, why didn't the Portland State come here to this group knowing that we are saddled with the responsibility of trying to make the tax system of the state work, as opposed to bringing this initiative on its own? I don't recall there being a presentation to us about this saying we are going to grab this payroll tax, which, by the way, I think we looked at when we were putting together the so-called Gang of Eight. We looked at the payroll tax in Portland, in districts, including Portland. So those sources of funding are limited. There's going to be an end to it. So I'm just curious why Portland State didn't come here and say, hey, we want to reach into this limited bucket of funds, in this case the payroll tax, and we know that you folks up here are charged with trying to sort this thing out. Mm-hmm. I'm just asking why you didn't come here before now.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think that that's something that you should ask. To be clear, we didn't ask to come here today. So we were here in response to an amendment. And so just to clarify the record. So I think it's a good question. I think that that's something that you might be interested in asking the sponsors of this ballot measure about why they felt like maybe that I think that I don't know. I don't want to speak for them.
Thank you. That's a perspective not from Portland. Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both for your testimony. And maybe LRO could answer, or either of you. I think the term balkanization of tax policy was used. And I'd like to know, is the opportunity to use a payroll tax within Metro for PSU simply a happenstance because Metro happens to be there and the payroll tax happens to be able to be collected by Metro? I know that's the case as it relates to transit districts, and that discussion we've been having and yesterday was had in another committee. But do other communities have this opportunity, or is it simply by virtue of the Metropolitan Service District and a historical
Metro
accident, one might say, that this community that might have this opportunity and others don't?
Is that a rhetorical question?
That's a question for anybody who knows the answer. Right. Because my assumption is that I think it's only because this happens to be Metro, which has the power to collect a payroll tax. I don't think another community in Oregon would have that. But maybe they do. If anybody has an answer.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Chair Bernhardt, Representative Davis, I can't really speak to other communities. I can say that the payroll tax is uniquely called out in Metro's charter, which also limits its jurisdiction to matters of metropolitan concern, which currently do not include funding for PSU.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with a lot of what's been said here by our partner. Each university is unique, but I think it is by virtue of being in this location, being able to capture a disproportionate amount of payroll tax from the business community given its location in the metro area. Perhaps the regionals, and I don't know this for sure, do a little bit better in the funding formula from the state, but I don't think they have that opportunity, whether it's because the mechanism doesn't exist mm-hmm. or because they're simply not the payroll base there for them to be able to do that in their own communities.
Okay.
And let me make a comment on it at the risk of embarrassing myself. I'd simply note that Oregon State and the University of Oregon have jurisdictions that overlap in a different way. I mean, Oregon State is the land-grant university, and therefore it has that jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. It also has a different set of expertise in terms of applied science that is certainly statewide and actually much bigger than the state of Oregon. You get students from all over. Ditto University of Oregon, which does draw a lot of students from, a majority of their students from Oregon, but from all over the state, and a very substantial number of students from outside of the state of Oregon. I think if I understood the argument correctly, and I'm not saying I agree or disagree with it, but I think the argument on the part of the Portland State University is, hey, we're a regional university. Most of our students come from this area. It's reasonable to assume that the people in our area might have an interest in supporting this regional university more than they would the other ones. And I have to say, unfortunately, I don't know the answer to your question as it applies to the four smaller universities. We have the college that used to be the normal school mm-hmm. in Western and the technical school in the South. But I frankly don't know where they draw their students from. I assume that most of them are regional, but I may be completely wrong about that. I don't know. Our universities are a historical accident and by design different from each other. Representative Nose, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just make a couple of brief points. One, we don't have a system anymore. We dismantled it.
Correct.
And so we have pretty much said each university is going to go on its own. We don't have a chancellor anymore. U of O, PSU, and University of Oregon all have a presence in the city of Portland, and they're doing it for very strategic reasons, all right? Like, because it's helpful if you have an MBA program at Oregon State or at the University of Oregon to have a presence in the dominant business sector in the state. So it makes perfect sense. So, you know, for what it's worth there. I just find it fascinating that we're all in favor of local control until we're not. I think there's nothing in the statute to stop another region from forming a metro of its own if it wants to do that. I'm not certain of that, but it's certainly an option that another jurisdiction of counties could explore, I would think, if they wanted to.
Good. Good. Thank you. Yes, Representative Davis?
Well, just to respond, I think first, I believe Metro is actually a creature of statute.
Yes. It is. Yes.
And then I think it raises the question of local control. Is there authority for a city? Could Eugene or Corvallis or Wilsonville and Klamath Falls, in the case of OIT, would we have the opportunity to impose a payroll tax? Or is that was sort of my first question, or is that unique to the formation of a metropolitan service district?
That's a great question. Representative Betts?
Thank you. It strikes me that this is a learning experience, I'm guessing, for PSU. And probably for all the rest of these little organizations as they get wound up and get going as standalone entities. And they're going to learn, as they just did today, that if they're going to play in this pond, they're going to have to show up here, because here you are. And so it strikes me that that the approach that they're going to have to use is going to have to involve the folks here, because these are common issues of common interest. And so, and I think your explanation of the other schools is a good one. And I think they also are going to still be playing here, even though they may think that they're now separate, standalone entities. But of course, they're not stuck with us all here in Oregon.
Right.
So, I'm happy to see you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yes. And so, I'm just looking forward to what we're going to hear from PSU next in regard to this issue.
Well, I hope that you hear that we're doing good things to improve college affordability and that we're keeping the doors open for those students who can't leave the Portland metropolitan region, and we're still fulfilling our mission. So hopefully.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. The way our rules work, it is perfectly appropriate for an amendment to be introduced like this one. I did not get notice of it, actual notice of it, until about a quarter to 11 today. I think it was prepared before that, but I didn't know about it until then. The other amendment, the dash one amendment, from which the dash three is derived, was posted last Friday, so people have been on notice that we were going to consider the other issue. This one, we were not on notice. Now, of course, the committee can overrule me if it wants to, but I suspect that if we're going to act on the dash four, and I have no idea what the committee's druthers are about that, we're going to want to hold another hearing on that. But at this point, at least, I think the other issue, if the committee wants to act on it, is ripe for that to happen. Now, I think I already asked if anyone else wanted to be heard on this public hearing, and I think I didn't get any answer. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4026. And colleagues, given the questions that have come up today, I'm going to hold over the work session on 4026 until tomorrow, give you a chance to think about it some more. But it is my intention to open a work session either tomorrow or Friday to consider the Dash 3 amendment. Obviously, if somebody wants to move the Dash 4, we'll consider that one too. Is there anything else? Paul, have I given the notice I need to give? I am. Okay. Anything else today? 6 minutes to the good. The committee is adjourned.